Greetings. Welcome to another Wednesday evening at the Clear Mountain Monastery community. And today we are so happy to have Lumpur Pasana with us here, actually in Seattle. Lumpur, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to read a little bit of your biography. I think it'll be I think it'll be relevant because we've got questions which kind of deal with the early parts of your life. And
okay.
Yeah, okay.
Isn't there anything more interesting we can talk about?
I think it'll shade into. So Lumpur Pasana was born in Manitoba, Canada in 1949. Lumpur is the most senior Western disciple in Venerable Ajahn Chah tradition in the United States and the most senior in the world after Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn K. Madamo. After finishing his studies at the University of Winnipeg, Lumpur traveled to Asia through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, to India, Nepal, and finally to Thailand, where he traveled to Wat Plang Vipassana Meditation Monastery in Chiang Mai. After a month-long silent meditation retreat, Lumpur took what he thought would just be a temporary ordination in January of 1974 at the age of 24. That temporary ordination grew in length and profundity when Lumpur traveled with his teacher to meet Lumpur Cha. Now, was in 75?
No.
No,
that was... No, that isn't quite how it worked.
Okay.
I first met Lumpur Cha like toward, I ordained January 4th, 1974, and then I kept hearing about the Thai forest tradition, kept hearing about Lumpur Cha, and so late January or early February, I went up to Ubon and went to Wat Pa Phong and paid respects to Lumpur Cha, and I spent about a month there, and I had the blessings of my preceptor, or my teacher. I wasn't my preceptor. My teacher at Wat Plang, he really encouraged me to go, and then that was when the story of my first meeting with Ajahn Chah, and him just, you know, I bow and I'm a complete newbie to everything, and then he just looks at me for the longest time, and he said, you know, very kind of deadpan, you want to stay here, you have to stay at least 5 years, that registered. and just seemed like impossible, and so I was really drawn to Wat Pa Phong, to Lumpur Cha, that's also during that time. I mean, there would have been the One Prat Lunar Observance Days, but there was also Magha Puja in February. And that, in those days, Magha Puja was when all of the branch monasteries would come together. And there was only, like, say at that time, maybe 16, 17 branch monasteries.
Compared to now, when there are over 300.
Now there's over 300, yeah. But still, you know, you get 200 monks together in one place, and then so many lay people, and they're all practicing and listening to Dhamma, and I can't keep up. No, I'm young, I'm enthusiastic, and it's just in, you're sitting on this concrete floor. I I didn't have the wherewithal. So anyway, then after a month, I can't commit to this, even though I was really inspired and, you know, again, both in terms of Lumpur Cha, but then also the the interface and the interconnection between the, just really seeing how it worked, the lay community and the monastic community supporting each other, and seeing that like monasticism was not some, you know, running off to the forest and being a hermit, but actually, you know, being of real service to the community and then seeing the sincerity and commitment of the lay community was very, very both inspiring and humbling. And so the idea of 5 years was, I mean, when you're 24, I mean, it's like the rest of your life. It's just, who can plan that far ahead? So then I went, and there was a small place that I had heard about and in central Thailand that I went and stayed at, Wat Sai Ngam in Suphanburi. And then I ended up staying there and ended up spending the range retreat. The teacher asked me to stay because I just kept thinking of Ajahn Chah all the time. And so then I went, I actually wrote and asked the Lupo Samedo, wrote back, gave me permission to come. He'd asked Lopo Chang and got permission to come for the range retreat. But then just before the range retreat, my teacher asked, he said, you know, I'm really busy traveling and going back and forth between this monastery, which he was just setting up, and his mother monastery, which he was just leaving. And he said, why don't you spend the range retreat? I can give more time teaching. And it was a very sincere request, and I thought, well, that, yeah, sure. Because they'd been great looking after me. And I had very good practice there. The environment was very good. But I was just feeling kind of drawn to Lopo Chah and the forest tradition, getting that fuller training in the lifestyle in Vinaya as well as the practice itself. So it was after the rains retreat that my teacher then said, wait, and then I've got an invitation up in that area after the Bhatsa for teaching, and I can take you take you to Ajahn Chah.
October 74.
It was late November, early December of 74. So that's when I went, and he brought me in and gave me the Lopo Chah. So it's very beautiful.
Well, that actually touches on a point that feels quite significant in terms of, it sounds like the experience at the monastery you spent the Voss at before returning to Longpo Cha was quite meditation focused and technique focused, and speaking to this, you know, monasteries and places you can go and practice in this more, as you put it, full or holistic way, is quite a new phenomenon in the West.
Yeah.
What would you say in terms of trying to speak to someone who's only had retreat experience and where that's been their metric, and you know, their practice has been measured by meditative attainment or calm based on a technique, versus this holistic approach you're talking about at the Ajahn Chah Ling Monastery, is like, what's unique about
what
that?
What you find about it is that it's actually following the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught in his very first sermon. It's not
the Onefold Path.
Yeah, it's an Eightfold Path that's laid out, that you've, the aspects of right view and right resolve and, you know, right thought process, you know, right thought formations, right action, right speech, right livelihood. How do you get on with people? How do you interact with the world? How do you take responsibility for your actions and your place in the world? And as well as the Buddhism is not a meditation technique. It's a training in one's whole life, body, speech, and mind. That's what Sila Samadhi Panya is like. In the tri-sikar, the triple training is sila samadhi panya. So like your virtue, integrity, training, and your actions, your development of meditation, of right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi, your training in wisdom. And so it's not about a technique of meditation, because that's, you know, it's one dimensional. When as human beings, we're a bit more than one dimension.
A follow-up on that, Lumpur, is, you know, I know some people who have touched the fruits or seen the fruits of that fully developed Eightfold Path, Noble Eightfold Path in someone, or have been to a monastery and felt what it feels like to live in line with that, and find the life that they return to at home is very distant from it, and because of obligations or karmic ties or whatever, aren't able to kind of bring their life into alignment with the Dhamma in the way they would want, and maybe there's too many things going on, or a job, or what would you tell to someone with one foot in the monastery and one foot on a banana peel, or who's not able to kind of feel like their life is in line with the Dhamma in the way they want, don't know what to do?
Well, I mean, I think nobody knows what they're doing. You talk to people in the monastery, am I doing the right thing?
You've heard a lot of me.
Doubt is ordinary, I think having Kalyanamitta is really just so important to the cultivation of the path and cultivation of clarity, that sense of having, you know, drawing close to good spiritual friendships, and having that contact. And of course the Buddha places that, you know, very much in the forefront of whether it's monastic practice or lay practice. Also, you reflect in terms of, you know, what are the four factors of stream entry? You know, your two external factors, two internal factors, saporisa sangseva, really, that association with noble beings, good beings, good human beings, good real human beings, not sort of complicated or living not so skillful lives, and sadhamma savana, the hearing of the good dhamma, hearing your good teachings, drawing close to those where you can receive and be in contact with good teachings and training. And it's just, so those external circumstances are incredibly important. So as a lay person, to be able to be attentive to creating conditions that are conducive. Are they going to be perfect? There's no such thing as perfect. And I've lived long enough in a monastery to know that most monasteries aren't perfect. So much of it is how do I live in a way that leads to contentment and clarity? It's just so important. And to not be either be, you know, beating oneself up with doubt and regret or second guessing oneself and all of the should haves and should be's that we torture ourselves with, and learning how to this is the way it is, and how do I live with this? I was on the plane today, the person next to me. I was saying, oh, because he is maybe a little bit younger than me, which means he was old. and I was saying, you must be retired now. We had a nice conversation, very good guy, very salt of the earth kind of character. And he said, well, I had to take retirement almost 20 years ago because I had an accident. It was at work for like a pre-trimming person.
A dangerous profession.
Yeah, and one of these big buckets, he was about 40 foot in the air, and it collapsed. And he said, I broke my neck, broke my back, broke my shoulder, broke my pelvis. I said, poof, you must have a lot of, you look like you've healed well, although I'm sure you've got, difficult issues with your body. He says, but yeah, well, I could cry every day, but what's the point? It's better to just get on with life. I choose what to pay attention to. What is it that's going to make me happy and make me feel that I'm living a useful life?
On that note, in terms of paying attention to things, you talk about coming from the meditation monastery where you ordained, where you had a lot of time for meditation, coming to Ajahn Chah's and then just seeing the beauty of the interaction between the lay people and the monastics. And I'm curious how your vision for what a healthy monastery and by extension a healthy monk, like what that means, because you see people come to a monastery and they've just got, I mean, myself definitely, included, come to a monastery and you had a very high ideal that a monastery should be, just meditation or, but it seems like you were able to see the integrated, like the essential aspect of.
Well, but that's my bias. of course I'm right.
Rick, but did you come when you were traveling across Europe and Asia? Like you left Canada, to come, and you were leaving, going to the complete opposite side of the world. So you were.
I was looking for something. I didn't really know what I was looking for. Excuse me. I didn't really know what I was looking for. I knew I was drawn to Buddhism because when I was a student, I did do a course of world religions and Buddhism just leaped out to me as something that spoke truth. And then the rest of my time in university was trying to take courses that I would be able to somehow access some sort of Buddhist theme in some way, shape, or form, at least a little bit. And then I did a lot of side reading and just try. But in those days, it was really hard to find. Yeah, any books. And I went to university, at University of Winnipeg, and just, even now it's a backwater. In those days, it certainly was as well. So it was hard to, I'd go to, our library didn't have a huge amount of Buddhist themed literature, or the public library. I go to the much larger University of Manitoba, and then a much bigger library. So I go out there and try to track down books. And I was interested in what Buddhism had to offer. I never came across any practice of meditation, even though it was sort of, you know, talked about in the books, and, but it was still very theoretical to me.
More in terms of bringing the theory down to practice, would you tell the story of the tiger in Dhaudam? Or, sorry, Wapuit? Yeah, Dhaudam?
Yeah, Dhaudam, yeah. Well, that was my... that was my first long Tudong. It was like a full year on Tudong and by myself a lot of the, most of the time. And that was the year I found Dhaudam. And they built me a kuti. So I was by myself, probably be a kilometer or two from the village, a kilometer or so from the village. So it's far enough to be completely isolated, but fairly easy to go along from. And they built me a great walking meditation path. And it was, I wore it really smooth. And then one night I'm on my jungle path. And I kind of hear a rustling and then I get a smell, which I had heard the description of the smell of a tiger. But then all of a sudden I got this smell and then, you know, my hair stood on end, and I was like, oh, that's a tiger. I couldn't quite see it. I mean, it's this very thick jungle. I mean, you've been to Dhaudam. I was in the bottom of a little side valley. So a little stream that went past, which was my water supply. So very lush and very thick, but I could hear it moving around me. Fear was visceral. But then what came to mind was the sutta where it's in the Majjhima Nikaya.
Bhayabhārava?
Bhayabhārava Sutta, Sutta number 4, Majjhima 4 or 6 or something, I can't remember. Something like that. Anyway, and then it's the Buddha recounting his own training of going out into the forest and experiencing fear and trepidation. And then what he did was continue practicing in the posture that he was in until the mood of fear dissipated. So then I said, well, okay, well, that's what the Buddha did. Maybe I should try it. So continued to just do walking back and forth, and spreading loving kindness and trying to calm the mind and settle the mind and come back to my breathing, come back to my body, try not to get obsessed with the reality of having a tiger right nearby. And then I walk for, you know, hard to tell how long. I mean, time was a bit of at a standstill at that point. I did walk for quite a while, and then really it was quite easeful. And then the presence of tiger fell away, and what was left was mindfulness and clear comprehension and a feeling of clarity. So then I thought, well, okay, then clear now. I could probably change postures, and I'll go. So I went and sat on my kuti had a little sleeping room and it had a little veranda completely open. So I went and sat on the veranda. And because the impulse was to go into the room and close the door, as if that would help. Because it's a pretty flimsy dwelling place, but still, the mind looks for such things. But anyway, so I went and sat, and then you know, sitting, meditation, breathing, you know, breathing in, breathing out, and it's sort of, that's a tiger. it's still there. And it was just this fear come up again, and then sort of, well, what would I do if a tiger attacked? And then it was just sort of like, then all the stories of kind of the capability of tigers came to me. So, well, you just die. That's all. You know, human beings are just incredibly puny compared to a tiger. So you just have to give up. So then that was, okay, it's just giving, the theme of giving up give myself to practice, give myself to the training, give myself to the Triple Gem, give myself to the Sila Samadhi Panya and the virtue, and then we'll see what happens. And I'm still here, so it worked pretty
spoiler.
Good.
Spoiler.
Spoiler. Yeah, spoiler.
Well, we have Lumpur for about 15 more minutes. People can put questions in the chat. We've got our first question here, and I might ask another one if we have time. But Nasco, Elwan, Hiron, if you have questions as well. Mm-hmm. But our first question is,
do you practice now also?
If so, how do you practice? Interesting.
Huh? If so, what?
How do you practice?
Huh?
Do you practice? Do you still practice? And if so, how?
I breathe in, I breathe out. Mindfulness, clear comprehension applies. You know, it doesn't really matter how old you are, how long you've been in the road. You continue. You can. I mean, practice is on a certain level it becomes more refined because it's not built on an edifice of I need this condition, I need this technique, I need to make the world fit into my perspective. It's around, you realize that there's this truth of the Dhamma, the truth of reality, and there's this capacity of the heart to penetrate it and to let go of all perceptions of self and clinging, and that's all you need to do.
Or could you, this really comes into my question, which was 2005, 2006, you led a retreat at Abhayagiri, basically talking about the breath. The whole retreat was on the breath, and Debbie's now turning that into a book. And just in conversation, you mentioned that you're going to be, it's not just going to be all those teaching from then, but you'll add how your understanding of breath meditation has changed in the last 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, 15, almost 20 years.
Yeah, and I'm
curious. Well, I mean, it changed. I mean, if you actually live skillfully, you actually mature and grow up.
As do your meditation practices.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Becomes a bit more clear. It's a natural. It's the images that the Buddha gives of the kind of the naturalness of the sutta where the rain falling on the mountain and then it gathering in little rivulets and then it gathering in little streams and then gathering. You know, it has a naturalness to it you're not having to fight. It's not as if you have to fight against Mara and fight against the defilements. It's like that like the blossom. I know you, Mara. It's not the clarity is there and things fall away.
Could you say a little bit more about that clarity? And you talked about just knowing there is this factor, the truth of Dhamma, and then somehow just being with that.
Yeah.
And could you say a bit more about that? Just how to be into that, or what?
Well, it's just recognizing that there is this. I mean, it's intrinsic to us all, but we get in the way. And that's exactly, what the Buddha, what's the actual problem? What's the source of suffering? Not greed, hatred, delusion. Are those intrinsic to the mind? No, we add them to the mind. That's like the Buddha sort of saying that this mind, bhikkhus, is radiant, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. It's stained by adventitious defilements. It's visitors. We spend our time receiving the visitors and getting caught up in the visitors and forget to pay attention to sort of the home base.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of academic speculation about that sutta. Does that all just fall away? I mean, when you're actually practicing,
if you practice it and you allow if you allow all of the, because you're trying to figure it out intellectually, never going to do it. The heart has to taste it. Mm-hmm. You have to feel it. You have to experience it. It's like Lumbha Cha. He had such a way with saying things in a really brief but really profound way. He said, first you have to know the Dhamma. Then you have to see the Dhamma. Then you have to be the Dhamma. Those are different levels of approach and a relationship with the Dhamma. So, you start knowing it, well, that's kind of your study, you're kind of trying this out, practicing that way, having this technique and that technique. But then you've got to learn how do I use it so that there's an increased clarity and understanding and a deepening of the insight, and then even that's not the end point. It's just the insight. You have to learn how to let go, to relinquish, release, and step into the Dhamma, to be the Dhamma, not have to carry any other identity with it, even the identity of me as a monk, me as a layperson, me as a human being.
Okay. We have quite a few questions that came very quickly. Hi, Ajahn's. How long should we stick to a meditation technique? How do we know when we should change things up?
Only through experience. Nothing's hard and fast. You have to be willing to experiment. You have to be willing to stick with something till it doesn't work. You have to be willing to give up something when it isn't working. But there's no hard and fast rules. You just have to. That's how you gain through experience, through a trial and error. Through being willing to experiment, see what works, what doesn't work.
Next, question I never heard before: is it possible to get enlightened living in a Muslim country where there are no monasteries?
Well, I mean, these days, the access to the teachings is really, it's accessible. Access to, so that living in a Muslim country and committing to a tree, because the conditioning factor, you know, even though, as I mentioned before, external conditions are important, but still, they're important to the extent that one draws close to people with integrity, people with goodness. And it's kind of like the question that Lompoha Cha asked. I mean, it's a little bit different point, but it's similar. In that Lompoha Cha asking Ajahn Sumedho when he was a young monk, oh, will you ever go back to America as a monk and live in America as a monk? And Ajahn Sumedho went off on this rant of, I'd never go back to America. This America is not a Buddhist country. I could never live in America. They wouldn't look after me. I'd just starve to death. And then Lompoha Cha had this kind of very kind of concerned and compassionate look. And he said, you mean there's no good people in America? and it's that simple. You know, do you draw close to people with goodness? Or do you... No, there's lots of idiots in America. There's idiots in Thailand, which is supposed to be a Buddhist country. You have to pay attention to who you draw close to. So living in a Muslim country, as I say, these days, the access to teachings is so widely available, but then trying to surround oneself with the conditions that are supportive.
This is a good one. So kind of on the theme of just what is a good person, this idea of metta. So, Venerable Sir, is there a difference between metta and non-hatred?
Well, to a certain degree, it's helpful to define terms, but recognize that you are defining terms, so that metta and not like non-hatred, like Lompoha Sumedho spent many years in his early teaching career in England defining metta as not dwelling in aversion. Because people would you conjure up an idea of metta, I've got to be gushing with loving kindness for every being if I'm going to try to cultivate metta. But and then Lompoha Sumedho said, if you can just not dwell in aversion, it's a great start, and it's a really perfect foundation. Is metta non-hatred? Well, yes, absolutely. By definition, it would be non-hatred, because it's like even in the the definition of samma sankappa, your definition of right thought, apayabhara sankappa, so not dwelling in ill will, is the definition, and it's usually, but then it's synonymous. You start looking at, it's a code word for metta, looking at it in its positive sense. But the Buddha, in many ways, is when you're trying to be precise, if you say it is, loving, this loving kindness and goodwill to all, you think, Oh, I never had lung cancer. But in order for it to arise and be present and establish itself, the foundation has to be that mental formation that is not bound by ill will, by hatred or aversion.
Before, you said you recounted that progression of knowing Dhamma, seeing Dhamma, and then being Dhamma. What is Dhamma in that context?
Well, Dhamma is, I mean, it's not just sort of teachings. And it's not, it's the actual, say, the true nature of things. Mm. You know, being able to know the true nature of things. It's not just knowing. I know the Four Noble Truths. Get the lists all down. But it's, I mean, that's part of it. And that's how you begin to lay a foundation. But it's more knowing, because that's more part of seeing Dhamma, maybe. I mean, it's a, that sense of that it really starting to, one's conception of Dhamma shifting into an experiential touching on the true nature of things. Flavor of peace and clarity that's possible.
Time for one final question. Are there any misunderstandings of Buddhism that have developed as it comes to the West that you would correct?
Yeah. That I would correct?
Yeah.
Oh, well. I don't know. I'm not on a mission. one of the misconceptions, of course, is that monasteries and monastic practice are selfish, that's certainly. Or that Buddhist practice is selfish, by extension, and there's plenty of that kind of perception, misconception, and if you're really practicing the precepts, practicing generosity and giving, and practicing right action. Right livelihood, you're really attuned to the communal nature of this human existence and how we have to care for each other as well as care for the environment around us. So it's very much an unselfish endeavor that is required to progress on the path.
In terms of, the environmental effects of being a monastic, just living, visiting a place like Abhayagiri, it's just such a simple place, and the monastics are living so simply. It's just a really good model.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things is that you see that there are examples of people living skillful lives. That's a useful thing, rather than, again, trying to be on a mission and trying to convert people to the true way.
Lompo, what would you say to two young monks on a mission to maybe start a community in Seattle?
Patience. Do it slowly. Do it. Put your foundations, your solid base of integrity and skill in the fundamentals.
Thank you so much, Lompo.
Okay. Yeah, great to be here.
So we'll be just wrapping up now. And for those who are familiar with our format, you may join me on Zoom I'll post the link in the chat, and if you can't see it, just visit clearmountainmonastery.org, and halfway down the page, there's a link to the Wednesday evening live stream where the Zoom link is, and we'll see all of you there. We'll also have teachings on Thursday evening, Friday evening, and the large ceremony teaching Saturday, so you can see that on the website. Longpour, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah, good to join.